nation. And so he calls Hosea to a very unusual way of life, as we'll see here in Hosea 1. It says, "When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, 'Go, marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her. For like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord.'" And so Hosea's like, okay, that sounds like a good plan. Now, I don't know where you go in the land of ancient Israel to find promiscuous women. I would assume you just go down to the local dive bar and you find the woman who's like showing the most ankle, you know? Or you go to the local strip club and you find the one with the most shekels stuffed in her veil. And he's like, that's the woman for me. That's the one God wants me to marry. And so he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. This is how we know it's a true account, because her name is Gomer. And they get married, and they have a kid together. Now, it was really normal for prophets at this time to give their kids symbolic names, and that's what God called on Hosea to do. He said to Hosea, call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. Jehu was a king that had arisen, and he had taken over after Ahab's family. And Ahab was like the worst king of Israel ever. He was really bad. And Jehu took out Ahab's family and in the process murdered all of Ahab's sons. And God said, you know, I did turn the land over to you. I turned the kingdom over to you. But that bloodbath was something that I was not cool with. And it may have looked that like I was overlooking it, that I was ignoring it, but I remember that. And my justice is going to come due. And it's going to be, you know, at Jezreel. In that day, I will break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel. You know, he promises in other places that he's going to use the nation of Assyria to do this, to bring his judgment upon the nation of Israel for moving so far away from him. Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call her Lo-Ruhamah, which means not loved, for I will no longer show love to Israel that I should at all forgive them. And so Gomer has a daughter who again gets a symbolic name, and God is saying, you know, this relationship with my people, it's coming to an end here, and I want everybody to know that. Yet I will show love to Judah, and I will save them, not by bow, sword, or battle, or by horses or horsemen, but I, the Lord their God, will save them. And so as Israel is looking at this nation of Assyria headed their way, it would be easy for them to think, well, maybe we're just not strong enough militarily. And what God is saying is, well, you've never been strong enough militarily. And Judah is certainly not strong enough militarily, and yet I am God. And so compared to the nation of Assyria, I am so much more powerful. You know, it's easy to be like, oh, big world power heading our way. And God's like, not impressed at all. I'm going to protect Judah, but you, Israel, by turning away from me, you have removed yourself from my protection. And so let's not pretend that it's not that you don't have enough military might. Let's call it what it is. You've turned away from me, and so I can't protect you anymore. After she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. Then the Lord said, call him Lo-Ami, which means not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Which sounds really harsh until you remember that God is the God of reality. And so there's a lot of people who like to go through the motions and pretend like things are okay, and God's like, I don't want to pretend anymore. You really want nothing to do with me. You're really not that interested in a close relationship with me. And so let's just call it quits if that's how this is going to be. And if you read carefully, you notice that the second two kids are probably not Hosea's, because it says that she conceived and bore him a son, but then the next two kids she just had. So at this point, she's probably already gone out on him. She's probably getting pregnant with other men's kids. And yet she's staying with Hosea, and Hosea is taking responsibility for them. And that's backed up by Hosea 2. Again, Gomer is synonymous with Israel, but as they're talking about Israel, they're also kind of talking about Gomer too. And it says, and I will not love her children, for they were conceived in prostitution. Their mother is a shameless prostitute and became pregnant in a shameful way. So not only is she going out on her husband, but she's getting paid for it, which is pretty bad. And what God is trying to communicate here is the pain that Hosea feels at his wife's unfaithfulness is the same pain that God was feeling at Israel's unfaithfulness. Because as God thinks about a relationship with his people, he's not thinking about a group of little kids that he just has to keep in line. He's not thinking about slaves that he can just do whatever he wants with. What he's picturing is a marriage relationship. He's picturing an intimacy where he can love his people and they will love him in return. And he's saying, Israel, you're going out on me and you're finding other lovers. You're finding other things to go after. And how were they shameless prostitutes? Well, in Hosea 4, it says they have deserted the Lord to worship other gods. They were finding other gods to worship. They ask a piece of wood for advice. They think a stick can tell them the future. In Isaiah, he talks about how there are guys out there who cut down a tree, and with one half of the tree, they cut it up and they use that as fire to cook their dinner. And the other half of the tree, they carve into a stick or into an idol. And then they bow down to that idol and they start asking that idol for advice. And he's like, you know what would be even better is to just throw that piece into the fire as well to keep cooking your dinner. You really think a piece of wood can tell you the future? Longing after idols has made them foolish. They have played the prostitutes, serving other gods and deserting their God. And, you know, from our perspective, you read this and you're like, oh, man, is God just like really insecure and kind of jealous and he can't handle people worshiping other gods? Until you consider a couple of facts. One, if God is who he says he is, then he is the creator of everything and he is the only God. And so to worship anything else is not just wrong, but it's foolish because there are no other gods that really exist. But the other thing to consider is what Israel got into, the practices they got into as they started worshiping other gods. Because the two main other gods that they worshiped were Baal, who's going to show up in this passage, and another god called Molech or Chemosh, depending on what country they took the name from. And Baal was the god of fertility. He was the one responsible for the crops because he would fertilize the earth. And the way that Baal was worshipped was through ritual prostitution. You would go to a temple and you would pay to have sex with a temple prostitute. The idea that being, hey, Baal, see what we're doing? Don't you want to do that to the land? So, I mean, it's kind of gross. But what's even more disturbing is when you learn that the temple prostitutes were young girls who were taken from their families without any say in the matter. And they were forced into this lifestyle. They were forced to have sex with whatever guy showed up at the temple until they either died as a result of that horrendous lifestyle or they got to the point where they were useless and nobody wanted them anymore and they were just discarded. I don't think it's too narrow-minded of God to say that that's kind of messed up. And Molech was a terrible god that people were terrified of. And so they would sacrifice their infants to him. And so God looks at those practices and he says, those are disgusting. Those are destroying you. Anytime we turn from God to worship anything else, it gets us into practices that destroy us. And so God says he has a promise with that. But even within that, there's a promise of restoration. Even as he's talking about how bad it is, he says, that's not the way it's going to be forever. He says in verse 10, yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. I'm moving against them. I'm going to wipe them out. But someday they're going to be numerous again. In the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called children of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will come together. They will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land. For great will be the day of Jezreel. So it's like, you guys aren't going to be two different kingdoms anymore. You're going to be one kingdom, which is true politically now, isn't it? And yet at some point in the future, they are going to come under God's leadership again. And instead of Jezreel being the place of God's judgment, it's going to be a place of triumph. Say of your brothers, my people, and of your sisters, my loved ones. So instead of lo, Ruhamah, lo, Ami, it'll be Ruhamah, my people, Ami, my loved ones. But God desires reconciliation even with the people who have turned against him. God's deepest desire is to be in close relationship with his people. And so even as he's promising judgment, he's saying, I desperately want to be back together with you. more than anything, I want to be close to you. Now, was Israel just drifting into this? No. It says in verse 5, she said, I will go after my lovers, who gave me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my olive oil and my drink. She was actively pursuing these other things. This was not just some ignorant mistake that she was making. Therefore, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. God's promising judgment because the love of God cannot be separated from the justice of God. If he wants to be Israel's husband, what kind of husband is it that says, oh, you know, my wife's sleeping around with all these other guys, but I just love her so much. That's not love, all right? That's codependency, and God is not a codependent God. And so he says, these things that they're into, that's being unfaithful to me, I need to do something about that because I am perfectly just. She will chase after her lovers, but not catch them. She will look for them, but not find them. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold, which they use for Baal. And so Israel's like, whoa, look at all this grain that I've produced. Look at all this gold and silver that I've made. And God's like, who gave you the ability to do any of that? Who do you think it was that blessed you with those things? Do you think that you were the one that came up with that on your own? No, I was the one that gave that to you. And you're turning around and using it for something that goes against me. They were taking God's gifts for granted. They were taking God himself for granted. Now, what are some signs that someone is taking God for granted? Because do you think the Israelites were the only one who ever did anything like that? Well, what about this? You complain about what you don't have instead of being grateful for what you do have. You forget the incredible blessings that God has given you, and you focus on everything that you've ever wanted that you haven't been given, probably haven't been given yet. And you spend a lot of time focusing on that and less time focusing on what God has already blessed you with. You resent any sacrifices for God. Any time, any energy, anything that you have to give up in order to pursue him feels like this huge weight, as opposed to something that God gave you in the first place that you're just giving right back to him anyway. You don't want to tell people about God. How messed up it would be if people asked me, so are you married? And I'm like, yeah. You kind of wonder what was wrong with that relationship. You would wonder how excited I was to be married if I don't want to tell anybody that I'm married or about my husband. And yet, we often do that with God, don't we? We're hesitant to tell anybody about him, about how great he is, about how great his grace is. Or using God's gifts for self. That's what Israel was doing. They were taking the things that God had given them, and they were turning around and using it for things that benefited them in some way, but had nothing to do with God. You know, taking gifts for granted is so easy to do. This is actually something that happened to me recently. This Thanksgiving weekend, my husband came to me. He's like, okay, wife, it's time to ruin your Christmas surprise. Because Black Friday was coming, and he was planning on taking the money that he and his parents were going to put towards my Christmas gift and buy me a new tablet computer. And so he had spent hours researching all the best possible options, and he wanted me to be able to pick exactly what I wanted. And so he showed me all the different options that he had researched, and I picked out the tablet computer that I liked. And he got up at 6 o'clock Black Friday morning and went and stood in line and bought the tablet and brought it back and spent hours configuring it and spent the next couple weeks getting the exact hardware that I wanted, so it was exactly what I wanted. Fast forward about 3 weeks to Christmas morning. We get up, the whole family's there, tons of gifts under the tree. And I'm sitting there, and I'm watching him open up big gift after big gift from his parents, and I'm like, I'm not getting anything. And I see another big gift, and I see another big gift. And it's not even like I'm not getting anything, but he's getting these really big gifts, and so I'm starting to think, well, you know, maybe they just saw his Amazon wish list and they thought that's what we both wanted. Or maybe they thought that mine was boring because it just has books on it. But that's what I really wanted, but I don't really need any more books because I have more than I can read anyway. And so it gets to the end of Christmas morning and I haven't gotten any big gifts. And so I'm sitting there trying to look all happy when really on the inside I'm like, does this mean something? How come I didn't get anything? And so about half an hour later, I casually make my way in, and I sit down next to Scott, and he's like, wow, that was a great Christmas morning, wasn't it? And I, very nonchalantly, am like, yeah, you got quite the haul. And he's like, oh, yeah, we probably should have wrapped up your tablet and put it back underneath the tree. And I was like, oh, my God. So a couple hours later, I'm telling him how I had just forgotten and was sitting there feeling bad about myself. And he's like, do you think we really should have wrapped up the tablet? And I'm like, no, I think the problem is my selfish, ungrateful heart had forgotten that 3 weeks ago I had already gotten my gift. And so I'm sitting here feeling bad for myself about what I wasn't getting, when the truth is I probably got the nicest gift out of everybody this entire Christmas. I'd forgotten. And yet, we do that with God, don't we? You sit around feeling bad about yourself for the things that you don't have, and you've forgotten that if you are a Christian believer, that you have been rescued from an eternity apart from God and brought into relationship with Him so you can be with Him and every other believer forever. And if that were the only thing that He ever gave you, you could be grateful for that. But that's not the only thing He's ever given you. He's given you an opportunity for deep relationships. He's given you an opportunity for purpose, to live life the way that He's designed you to live. He's given you an opportunity for joy, for peace. And we sit around and we're like, but my buddy got a new car. And we just take the gifts of God for granted. And God says, you do that, you start forgetting, and that makes you turn to things that are going to destroy you, that are not going to be fulfilling. And that's what Israel was getting into. And God says He has to do something about that. He says, therefore, I will take away my grain when it ripens and my new wine when it's ready. I will take back my wool and my linen intended to cover her naked body. So now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers. No one will take her out of my hands. It's this image that she's running after all these other gods, and God kind of exposes her for who she is, and He's like, does anybody else want this? No. I will stop all her celebrations, her yearly festivals, her new moons, her Sabbath days, all her appointed festivals. Now, these festivals were appointed by God. And yet, again, He's like, if we're doing this just to go through the motions, just stop. I don't want you going through the motions anymore. These festivals were a way to draw close to me. And if you're going to use them just as a way to get my blessing as you turn to other things, I don't want to go through the motions anymore. I will ruin her vines and her fig trees, which she said were pay from her lovers. I'm the one that gave it to her. She starts thinking that she's getting these from other places, so I'm just going to take them away. I will make them a thicket, and wild animals will devour them. I will punish her for the day she burned incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after her lovers. But me she forgot, declares the Lord. This relationship is going south really fast. And yet you hear the anguish in God's heart as He's saying these things. You hear the hurt that He's trying to express. His anger is a righteous anger, but He's not just angry. He's sad because He wants to be in relationship with His people. But again, it doesn't stop there. He goes on to say, therefore, I am now going to allure her. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. A lot of times God strips us down so that we have the opportunity to hear Him and realize that we have nothing else left and we're willing to turn to Him, which says something about the humility of God, that He's willing to be our last option. And so if you're in the wilderness right now, it may be that God has led you there so that you can hear from Him. Therefore, I will give her back her vineyards and will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There she will respond as in the days of her youth, as in the day she came up out of Egypt. He's like, do you guys remember Egypt? You remember what it was when I brought you out of slavery and you became a free people? You remember how awesome that was? Remember how excited you were? I want to get back there. That's the type of relationship I want to be in with you again. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. Again, the intimacy piece. This is the type of relationship He wants with His people. I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day, I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds in the sky, and the creatures that move along the ground. bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land so that all may lie down in safety. I'm going to give you security. I'm going to give you rest. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. I love those verses. Those are the verses my husband and I used on our wedding invitations because it was the type of relationship we wanted with each other. But the reason we knew that was possible was because that's the type of relationship the Lord had with each of us. That's the type of faithfulness that God had expressed to each one of us. In that day, I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the skies, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond to the grain, the new wine, and the olive oil. And they will respond to Jezreel, that valley. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called not my loved one. We will be restored. We will get back together. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people, and they will say, you are my God. So again, God, the God of justice, shows that that's not his deepest desire, that he wants to forgive, that he wants to reconcile, that he wants to be back together with his people. And he promises that this is going to happen someday. You know, he's asking for intimacy, which leads to the question, what does intimacy with God look like? We desire intimacy in our relationships, and it can be kind of a nebulous thing. I think it's helpful to ponder what intimacy is not. So I have a couple examples of intimacy gone awry. Intimacy is not naked family photos. I don't care how long and flowing the guy's locks are. I don't care how lovely the flower is in her hair. Nobody wants to see this, all right? This is not bringing people into your relationship in a healthy way. It's not better if you make it a Christmas card and go with a towel. That's not good. And for the love of God and all that is holy, never, ever use cats. That's an abomination right there, all right? These are actual photos. We're going to move past that one. And, you know, those photos are ridiculous. I mean, really. But I think it does show that we genuinely desire to include people in our lives, right? Why would you post pictures like that? Why would you even have pictures like that taken in the first place? But I think that we long for deep connections. And we go about it in some really weird ways, but God says that he's designed us to connect deeply with other people, but it's because he's designed us to connect deeply with him. He wants to be an intimate relationship with us. He wants to be the closest relationship that you have. And so what does intimacy with God look like? Well, it means you're honest with him about the things you're thinking and feeling. There's no part of your life that's just held back separate from him. It means you're seeking his direction and his approval. As big decisions come up in your life, are you asking him what it is that you want him to you to do? You know, and his approval. Imagine some guy came up to me and he's like, you know, I don't really think you're that cool. And I don't really find you that attractive. And the things that you like, I think, are kind of lame. I'm going to be like, whatever. My husband thinks I'm cool. God thinks I'm cool. Who are you to tell me what anything about me? And we should kind of have that same dynamic with God. That if we know that the God of the universe loves us and approves of us, it kind of doesn't matter as much if other people think that we're weird for following him. It means telling other people about him, being so excited that you just want to share that intimate relationship with others. It means choosing to believe his word. He's revealed himself to you. And are you going to go to that? Are you going to believe that? You know, and how do you know if your intimacy with God is growing? Well, here's a couple questions you can ask yourself. Am I enjoying my time with him? Is my time with the Lord every day, sitting down, opening up his Bible, spending time in prayer with him, is that something that I'm enjoying more and more every day? Length of time is not nearly as important as depth of connection with God. And do you find that that is growing? Is my trust in him growing? What happens when you go through hard times? Do you find that those are drawing you closer to God, or are you pulling away from Him and getting alienated? How are my relationships with those other kids? God says that not only does He want to be like a husband, He also wants to be like a father, which means that everybody else who has Him as their father is your brother or sister. And I know I've got kids now, and the weight of my heart is you love my kids. And so you can't say that you love God and then have nothing to do with His other children. The more you love God, you'll find the more you actually love His other kids. Am I growing in wisdom? Are you trusting His perspective on the way that life works more and more? And, you know, it's kind of a nebulous thing, but it grows gradually. Okay, you can't compare your intimacy with God to what it looked like last week or the week before. You kind of have to look over a longer period of time, but it is helpful to think, am I closer to God than I was 6 months ago? Am I trusting God more than I did a year ago? And you'll find that if you're really taking some of the steps suggested here and you're talking to other people about things that they're doing in order to grow closer to God, you'll get to the point where you realize, I can't remember a time when I didn't feel close to Him. And it's so sweet. And so intimacy with God, it's something that He desires, and yet there's a lot of blockers to it. And the main one that I want to talk about tonight is what comes up next in Hosea. In Hosea 3, this is the final stage in Hosea's marriage. The Lord said to me, go, show your love to your wife again, though she's loved by another man and is an adulteress. So at this point, Gomer's probably been gone for a while. And God says, I want you to go get her back. I want you to track her down, even though she left you. I want you to be the one to take the initiative. Because that's what God does with us. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. It's a bad sign when you get into sacred raisin cakes. Those were probably part of the ritual prostitution that happened. And so he's like, you know, even though the Israelites are cheating on me in ways that are pretty gross, I still love them and I still want to pursue them. So I bought her. This means that at this point, Gomer has sold herself into slavery, which means that the guys that she was fooling around with, they don't want her anymore. It means that the guys that paid her for sex, they don't want her anymore. And so she's gone ahead and sold herself into slavery so she doesn't starve to death. And Hosea had to go down to the slave auction to purchase his wife. And I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethek of barley. The going rate for a slave was 30 pieces of silver. And so Gomer has to stand up on that slave block, which is a large stone that the slaves had to stand up on so that they're up over the crowd. He gets stripped naked so that the purchaser can see their goods, and the auctioneer calls out, 30 pieces of silver. No answer. 25, no answer. 20, no answer. 15, sold. Imagine Gomer on that slave block. She knows someone just bought her, and for a ridiculously low price. She knows she's not worth much to anyone at this point. And the crowd parts, and who walks forward to claim her? The guy she left a long time ago. How would you be feeling if you were Gomer right now? The word shame is what comes to mind for me. So ashamed at this point of how far she sunk and the fact that Hosea is there to see it. How does shame feel? Bet you a lot of you guys could come up with a lot of different answers to this. A few that I thought of. Wanting to disappear, wishing that the ground would just open up underneath you and swallow you so you can disappear and nobody ever has to see you again. Hating people who see you this way. Hating that they know how far you've fallen. Hating how exposed you are. Sinking feeling in your stomach. You get all sweaty and shaky, either when it's happening or even when you remember what happened that one time. Feeling like you'd pay anything for that memory to disappear. Any amount of money so you never have to experience that memory again. And what happens when we get mired in shame? What happens to your life and to your relationships? Well, hiding. You have to hide so that nobody sees you like that again, but that just leads to more hiding. You can't hide just one part of your life, and so you're separating more and more and hiding more and more, angry and defensive, either if you get exposed again or if somebody brings up that time that you're so ashamed of. You either have to pull back or you have to attack so that they don't know how bad you felt about that. Deadening your emotions, trying not to feel that shame, but then in the process, deadening every other emotion that you have. Depression, self-punishment, withdrawal from people and ultimately from God. And, you know, this is something that really strikes home for me. It's something I've had a lot of experience with. My junior year of high school, I became sexually active with my boyfriend, and it was summer in between my junior and senior year that I got pregnant. And I didn't know that I was pregnant. I just know that I got really, really sick. And I lost a bunch of weight. I got super dehydrated because I was just puking constantly. And so my family was taking me in to doctors. I had to go into the emergency room a couple of times because I was so dehydrated. And the second time I went into the emergency room, they ran a bunch of tests. And one of the tests they ran on me was a pregnancy test without telling me because they were just running a bunch of tests. And one of the clearest memories of that time was lying in my hospital bed at the emergency room, and the doctor came in and told me that I was pregnant. And I remember thinking, if the hospital could collapse on top of me right now, then that would probably be okay because I never want to face anybody with this. And I was so ashamed of being caught in that situation that I decided to have an abortion because I thought this will take care of the problem, then I'm not going to have to worry about it anymore. But the problem with that was not only did I have the shame of being caught in that situation, but then I had a tremendous amount of guilt as a result of the decision that I had made. You know, I've talked to other women who have had abortions, and what they compare it to is an animal getting caught in a trap, and the animal will gnaw its own foot off to escape from the trap. And that's really what it felt like. And as a result of that shame, I pulled away from almost all of my relationships. I grew up in upstate New York, and I chose to go away to Penn State for a couple of years just to get away from everybody, to try to forget. But my problems followed me. And I found that I couldn't build close relationships because I was terrified of people finding out. I transferred to Ohio State. Things continued to get worse. And it got to the point where I really felt like nobody wanted me. Because what if they found out about this one thing that I had done? And I carried that with me, and I was terrified of being exposed until I came into a relationship with Christ, until I learned that the reason that Christ went to the cross was to pay for things like that, and that God fully acknowledged that what I did, not just there, but a lot of other things that I had done wrong were sin, and yet forgiveness was available through his grace. And so I came into a relationship with Christ. I allowed his death to cover my sins, and yet the shame still followed me. I couldn't seem to shake it. And that shame can be something that clings to us, that we feel like no matter how many times we wash, we can't get clean. Breaking out of shame requires addressing the underlying problem. You don't believe that God really wants to forgive you. Martin Lloyd-Jones puts it this way. He says, the trouble with this type of unhappy Christian is that he does not really believe the scriptures. Have you thought of that? You say, my trouble is that terrible sin which I have committed. Let me tell you in the name of God that that is not your trouble. Your trouble is unbelief. You know, if you're getting mired in shame, you know what you're saying? You're saying that the death of Christ was not sufficient payment for what you have done wrong. That there's something else that you need to do in order to be able to make up for it. And God is saying, what else could possibly be needed in order to pay for the things that you've done wrong? You simply need to receive my forgiveness. You need to admit that you have nothing to offer me, and then I can give you everything. And so for people who have never received that grace of God, believe that that is sufficient to cover your sins. But for those of you who are already Christians, if you're sitting around feeling bad about yourself, you don't understand what God is trying to tell you. You know, the grace of God, in the Old Testament, he was trying to show that he was a just God, but then his wrath was poured out on Christ. And so in the New Testament, there's no chance that God is going to judge anybody who is his people. There's no chance that he's going to turn away from you ever, because as soon as you come into a relationship with him, you are perfect forever in his sight, no matter what your life looks like, because it's something that he bestows on you. Oswald Sanders puts it this way. He says, the new covenant, the way that God relates to us under grace, is not a message directed to the spiritual elite, but it's tailored to meet the needs of men and women who have utterly failed. It's a covenant for failures. Do you feel like a failure? Well, that's what God's grace is for. And guess what? The message is, we're all failures. Even you people who feel like you haven't done anything that bad, well, it's because you're denying something. So you're either in some sort of delusion or you're mired in shame, but guess what? Grace answers both those things. Grace brings you into reality that you are a sinner, and then it forgives you. This is what he promised in Isaiah 54. He said, fear not, you will no longer live in shame. Do not be afraid. There's no more disgrace for you. You will no longer remember the shame of your youth and the sorrows of widowhood, for your Creator will be your husband. The Lord of heaven's armies is his name. That's how powerful he is. That's how big he is. He is your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of all the earth. This is the God who rescues you and redeems you. And so God wants to bring you out of that shame so that you can experience intimacy with him, so you don't have to be afraid of being exposed anymore. But then the cool part about that is it enables you to carry that message of hope out to other people. Because if you're mired in shame, you're just focused on yourself. I'm such a bad person. I've done so many bad things. What about me? I think we kind of like shame because it lets us think about ourselves. And yet God says, I don't want you thinking about yourself quite as much. I want you thinking about me, but I want you thinking about other people as well. And if you get stuck in shame, you are not going to be able to talk to other people about how great God is. This is something the Apostle Paul understood. Listen to what he says in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, for I am the least of all the apostles. In fact, I'm not even worthy to be called an apostle after the way I persecuted God's church. Paul, the great apostle, probably the greatest Christian who ever lived. You know what he used to do? He used to kill Christians. And he could have sat around feeling really bad about that, but instead he's like, I feel really unworthy, but my unworthiness just drives me on. But whatever I am now, it is all because God poured out his special favor on me, and not without result. For I have worked harder than any of the other apostles, yet it was not I, but God who was working through me by his grace. It's like I applied his grace to the things that I've done wrong, and it's propelled me outward to love other people. I don't know how many times people have come to me and said, you know, if you can experience freedom and forgiveness for what you've done, maybe the Lord can forgive me too. And who gets the credit for that? Is it because of me? No. How can I claim credit for God taking one of the worst things I've ever done and turning it into something good? And yet that's the God of the Bible. He's a God of redemption. He loves taking the terrible things and turning them into something that he can use so that he's the one that gets all the glory. So it's his grace that's magnified. Breaking out of shame will enable you to be a light of hope for other people so that you can carry God's message of grace out powerfully and convince people that it's possible for them too. And so a few conclusions from the book of Hosea. One, this is not a book about how to have an awesome marriage. Do not try to be Hosea. That's not why he wrote this. You're not going to be really spiritual if you find like the worst possible spouse ever. All right? Don't go there. The point of the book is to show God's crazy and radical grace, to show how much he loves his people and how much he wants to be in relationship with us. And so the real question is, will you respond to the God who is willing to take you back? And so that's the message of Hosea. And we have time for a couple of comments or questions if anybody has anything. Yeah, back here.
Okay. So shame has been something for me that I've struggled a lot with. I had a lot of bad relationships all throughout college and really used men a lot to make myself feel better or feel like I was important or wanted, and experienced like some abuse in my childhood. So it's been something ongoing for me. And I know reading Hosea has just been incredible to realize like God wants to take my absolute worst failures and turn them into something hopeful and good. And it really shows his goodness and power to do that. And one night, one of my roommates, we were reading a book all together about relationships, and I was just, like, feeling really bad about myself afterwards. And I was like, man, like, I'll never go anywhere. Like, I'm just awful. I'm this horrible person. And I just remembered, like, in Acts 10:15, it says, do not call anything impure that God has made clean. And it's like this idea that like what God has made clean and pure and good, which he says he's done to us who are in Christ, nobody has the right to call them unclean or condemned or wrong. And so that's just been my experience with that.
That's really cool. And that's a good point, that sometimes shame is a result of things that other people have done to us, but it still is the underlying problem of not believing that we really are made pure. And it's funny that you bring that up, that God's like, you can't call somebody impure. You can't even say that about yourself. Because you're like, no, I'm really bad. And God's like, do you know who you're talking about? You're talking about my daughter. And I don't let anybody talk about my daughter that way. Not even my daughter. You know, he really wants us to understand how much he loves us. And to do anything otherwise would be to disagree with him. And so we might as well just go ahead and have the faith to agree with him. That's cool. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, right here.
I just wanted to highlight a point that you made that I really loved, and it kind of fell in the cracks there as you were talking, and I just wanted to bring it out. But I was really struck when you said that God is willing to be our last resort.
Mm-hmm.
How he, you know, in that moment, it sort of waits for, you know, we turn to all these other things, and God is always standing in the background waiting for us to turn back. And it's that to me just really strikes me in a way that is unbelievable.
Yeah, he is so humble and patient with us, and thank God for that. That's really cool. Yeah.
I think there's a really practical application for this for our lives, like in how we first go to approach God. And I think it comes up in a bunch of passages, but just first approaching God about how he feels about us, not how we feel about him. My favorite example is in the psalm where David had just committed adultery and murdered a man. And the first thing that he says to God is not, you know, I want to follow you, I love you. He says, you love me. He says, be gracious to me because of the love you have for me. And I think that's like the result of that in my life is the periods of time where I'm just like totally like, you know, in the gutter are much shorter now.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, that's just become a habit where it's like when I'm feeling that way, to kind of have a first reaction to go to God, like, right now you love me. And just like, that's how you're feeling about me right now. And then it's just like, you know, the fog, there's still fog, but it clears much faster when you kind of have that as a, trying to make it a habit.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, our feelings are really fickle, but God is constant. And so no matter where I'm at, we know that his opinion has not changed. And in Hebrews, it says we approach the throne of grace with confidence. And so we come in and we're like, oh, man, I haven't been that close to you, and I'm really sorry. And God's like, look, no. Grace covers that, too. Just come on into my presence, and I will tell you how I feel about you. So, yeah, that's a great point. Oh, right here.
Maybe I'm focusing on the wrong thing, but why does Hosea wait till 15 shekels to buy Gomer?
You know, that's a good question. The text does not say. It may be that was the starting rate for her because they knew she wasn't going to get much. But, yeah, the point is definitely that nobody else was going to buy her for any other price. Okay. So, yeah, that's a good question, though. Yeah, Karsh, last one. That side, there you go.
I really liked your point about how it's like gradual. Because I'm going through like a bunch of different stuff right now, and I'm just like, oh man, everything sucks, and this has changed. It's been really cool. It's been other people pointing it out too, and even thinking back like myself, like, oh, this actually has, and it's like something that you have to think about that it's like a gradual process. Cause I'm like, well, I want to be here. Like, all right, cool. I'll do this thing. I'll do that thing, and we're all done, and everything's good again. But that's like not how things work. And so I think I really like your point about how it's gradual, because that's like so important. I feel like it's something that is so easy to lose sight of when we're trying to work through something that's like really hard, and just doesn't have an easy answer. And when we know that this is gonna be like a long-term thing, I think it's so easy to be focused on the negative side of that. But it's cool to like look at like the gradual, like, man, like God's gonna take you. I think it's to like way farther along in this mm-hmm. than we could like ever imagine. And so I think that's, like, a really good point about the gradual.
Yeah, you know, our timeline is way too short. And I remember early on, I heard a couple things that were really helpful. Is one, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And so we're in this for the long haul, and we got to hang in there. The other point I remember somebody saying is, it took me a long time to get as messed up as I was. And it's going to take more than a couple of months to straighten some of that stuff out. And even now, I sometimes feel like, man, I still have so many problems, and I still get so confused about things, and there are times when I don't even really want to talk to God, and God's like, well, do you remember when 5 years ago you couldn't even, you know, finish a spiritual book, and you remember 10 years ago when you couldn't even be consistent in my word? Things are looking a lot better now, aren't they? And so a lot of times it helps just to lengthen the timeline that we're looking at things, and it can be really encouraging that way. Cool. Why don't we pray?